Hello, everybody. This is Ground Zero Growth. I'm your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbod. I'm joined today with Tate Fisher, owner of Catalyst Group. Tell me, Tate, did I miss anything in that introduction? I failed to ask you how you wanted me to introduce yourself. So, can you take a moment to kind of more formally introduce yourself? I might have missed some things. You've probably done way more than that.
Well, that's a great question. The answer is I, lifelong business owner and entrepreneur, was super blessed to grow up in farming and ranching. So understood the idea of working in corporate America was just something that was literally never on my radar from the time I was a little kid. And so I've always known, like, it's been a surprise to exactly no one that's ever known me that I'm a business owner. I really have never I've never had a resume, because any of the things I've had that were jobs were outside sales, and so I can't even remember, except for maybe when I was a kid, even applying for a job. So it's hard to go all the way back to that. I just have a deep love for entrepreneurship. So the last 10 years, 15 years of my life has been completely dedicated to helping other small business owners grow. And I think, well, I'm sure we'll get into more of this, but over the last 10 years, I've really fallen in love with the franchising space. And so our focus has been on franchising because it's like the best of both worlds. We get to work with these big brands with big economics of scale and big problems to solve. And at the end of the day, we're solving all those problems for a bunch of small business owners. So, have had several successful businesses. More educationally, I've had several super unsuccessful businesses, right? The
Right.
ones that The ones that don't work, unfortunately, tend to be better education sometimes than the ones that do. And so I think that's so that's I guess that's probably that's the story in a nutshell for sure.
So I love, and you'll forgive me, I always get random unorthodox questions come to me sometimes
Sure.
in this introduction. So I've got some good ones. So but before we go too much into it, let's talk specifically about what you're doing currently. What is Catalyst Group? And you mentioned helping franchisees and franchisors. Can you kind of dive a little bit more into that?
Yeah, so the easiest way to answer that question is to back up 20 something years, where me and a business partner decided to open a chain of our own stores at the time. So we were an Alltel dealer and partner. If anyone remembers Alltel before Goldman Sachs bought them and sold them to Verizon, but we were one of their top retail partners, and so we were opening chains of Alltel stores. And during that process, we had a lot of success, which was a combination of doing a lot of right things at the right time in the right place, right? So it was getting lucky and good, right? And during that success, one of the hardest parts was is when you're growing that business, there's a lot that goes into opening these small service environments. And so trying to do organic growth and open new locations is really challenging. And we really, really struggled to find, the construction industrial complex, as I talk it, really works against you, right? They're not designed to open fast, lean, multi-locations. They are designed holistically to create unique snowflakes over a long period of time, right? It's designed to open hotels and restaurants and hospitals and schools and custom homes, right? Everything's unique, not something that is the same over and over again rapidly. So we run into that problem, and we ran into it as our trying to open our own locations. We had about 50 projects of our own during the time that we had those brands, and just beat our head against the wall. Somewhere around 2006, 2007, we started getting calls from other people that we knew in the industry saying, "Hey, man, your guys' stores perform better. They look better. You guys are growing like crazy. Like, how do we, like, who does all that for you?" And it was all, well, we were just solving all our own problems. We bought a sign company, we had an internal facilities team, and we were just doing our own thing to solve our own problems. And lo and behold, we got the opportunity to start helping other people that were opening locations. Fast sold all three of our retail store chains, and I actually not long after that, I bought my original founding partner out because I said, "Man, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to go help as many other folks open locations as I possibly can." And so been on that journey since 2013, so for 10 years now. And that's what we've been doing. Not obviously coming out of wireless. Wireless operates in like a dealer agency model, similar to insurance agents or car dealerships. So we have a lot of experience working in that world. But along the way, we started working with franchise brands. And since that time, we've basically now 80% of the work we do is ultimately with franchise brands of some kind, where we're helping them and their franchisees open new locations. So, and I can talk about our framework for doing that as I can talk for hours about our framework for doing that because I'm super passionate about it, but.
Well, and I almost, there's a part of me that almost kind of wants to. I had another question, and I'm worried I'm going to sideline it because I really wish I could remember the context. But I was talking to somebody the other day, or maybe listening to even something, where they mentioned creating a world and a framework. Oh, I remember it now. Where they went from opening so many stores per year to opening one store per week. And that I think that's what you're talking about, basically
That's
creating a
exactly it.
framework model where that's possible. Because I mean, if we know, I think it's easy for other people to understand how difficult it would be to open up a McDonald's store, or even just a standard coffee shop or whatever it is, right? Over the course of, small business owner starting that off from scratch, that's a year-long, maybe multi-year ordeal to get it up and running and stable, and then the notion of scalable, and then, one per week sounds
Yeah.
like a near impossible
It's
world.
the well, it's all about perspective and it's all about understanding how to solve that problem, right? So the fastest brand we've ever supported was opening 3.5 or 3.8 locations a week for almost 22 months. So we ran for almost 2 years opening 3.5 locations a week for one brand that we worked with. That was the fastest pace I've ever seen a brand grow. And I would argue that that's probably very, very few brands have any business growing at that pace. A lot of stuff breaks when you're growing that fast. And so we see a lot of brands, but we see a lot of brands that are growing a location a week, which is just a super, super healthy, fast pace.
What does it look like? I'm sorry, but just to make sure I understand and dive more in detail, what does it look like? I mean, obviously it's not from start to finish done in a week. It's more you've got multiple irons in the fire, and the way it pans out over the course of X, now we're opening up one per week. What's that X typically?
So, well, the answer is, I mean, the time frame to from start to finish for a project, has varies
It's going to vary.
wildly by concept, right? So, I mean, we have some brands that that it's an 18-month process to get a location open because it's incredibly complex, right? And there's a lot of things that they have to overcome. And we
A
have other
really
ones where,
big, like a really big thing, or a really big entertainment-based business is going to be completely different than a small, there's one person manning everything coffee shop.
That's exactly right. You nailed it on the head, right? So on the absolute other end of the extreme, we've got a couple of these guys that, they can get locations open in 6, 8 weeks, from signing the lease to actually getting open, right? Because their build outs are very, very, straightforward, right? So, where they're going into existing locations with that's a vanilla box. And really what they've got to do is put in paint fixture and floor, paint, flooring and whatever their internal fixturing systems are or whatever, right? So there's almost no construction scope at that point. And those guys can move really fast. So it varies pretty wildly, but all of them are in the same place that it's like, okay, well, we're going to overlay that timeline, right? And run pair and we're running all those projects parallel path, with a target of saying, okay, well, we're going to open one on average about once a week. And some, and it's every brand's a little bit different. We have brands that are, opening one a month, opening one a week. We have them, two or three a month. It just, it depends. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you're always, navigating all the different ones, and what hurdles and obstacles they run into. But that's a big part of what we do is say, okay, well, we know about 100 obstacles that we run into consistently every time. So we're going to put in place everything we possibly can to make sure that we can plow through all the known obstacles that we possibly can. So that way, right? Because it's like if the we need to get rid of the ones we know about, and that way everyone has time and energy and effort to focus on, the handful of unique things that come up, and are dealt with every single time. So, to back it up, to answer your question a little bit and back it up, when people ask us, like, what do we do? It's like, well, there's three main problems that a growing, scaling multi-location service brand has. The first one that they have to solve is, they have to create success to begin with, right? In franchising space, you talk about that most often in what they call unit level economics, right? Can you create, let's talk about coffee shops. Can you create a coffee shop that makes money, right? Consistently, right? So does each location create success in and of itself? Because ultimately, if you can't do that, right? If you can't create unit level economics, if every location doesn't create success, to the right level, right? Then you don't deserve to scale, right? So like that's it does that if that makes any sense, right? Like there's no reason to scale failure.
I agree. Okay, so I, this is so, but it's fun. I almost kind of want to push back a little bit for joking purposes. I heard so a buddy of mine met the original owner of Subway. And transparently, I'm not even sure if I would have guessed they're a franchise model now, but
They're the largest franchise model.
okay, thank you. So, and they asked Fred, something I can't remember his last name, but they asked him, what was kind of your key to success? And it was interesting to me because it was unexpected. He asked him, how profitable was your first store or whatever? And it was like, not really profitable. It's like, okay, well, what gives? And he's like, well, I just kind of scaled to the point to where people assumed we were, and then all of a sudden we were, and then, but it's interesting to your point. I think that's kind of a snowflake concept. I would agree. He probably had, you would hope he had some degree of a blueprint that was clear, like, we've got a little profitability, but not much, but we can scale this and be way more profitable.
Well, there's economics of scale that makes that increase the level of success, right? So think about it in supply chain negotiation and cost of materials and goods and all that kind of stuff, right? So obviously the more locations you have, the more profitable each location should be in theory, right? That's kind of the point. But if when we talk about brands, we have a gear framework where we talk about size and pace of brands, the speed and of growth that they have. And that first gear that we talk about is brands getting up to that first, 3 to 10 locations, right? And in that first year, if you can't create a profitable organization, in that first year framework with 3 to 10 locations, more locations isn't your problem, right? And we have people that talk about that all the time. They're like, well, if we just had economics of scale, if we just, then we could lower. And it's like, no, that's you can increase your level of success by scale, but I've never seen or worked with a brand that didn't have success in that first 3 to 10 proof of concept stage, that
That
ended
scale.
well as they scaled. There's several that didn't end well that I can think of that we didn't work with, but our industry, I would say, case studies or tales of woe. But
So
yeah.
is that gears thing semi-standard? I found myself used since you and I first talked. The geared grade scale that you created, I found myself using that, interestingly enough, in just conversations with other people that talk about their ideal client. Because it's like, well, my ideal client is a coffee shop. And then I'm instantly like, well, is it gear one or two?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a combination of size and pace, but that's where we get into where we developed that gear framework. And the reason it became gears is because it was relative to, we found ourselves constantly saying, well, the problems that you're facing are a combination of size and speed, right? So at the end of the day, whether you have 500 existing locations or five, if you're trying to open 50 locations next year, your problems look very similar, regardless of whether you have 500 or five locations, right? Your resources look different, but your problems are very similar. And so ultimately, when it relates to opening new locations specifically, the speed and growth that you're trying to achieve dictates what problems you're going to face more so than how big you are. To a degree, ultimately, size plays a part in it. Because size makes change management harder, right? So that's where that kind of gets into. So depending on which problem you're trying to solve, depends on whether or not size is a place. But I think the answer is, I mean, I won't say, I think our 5-year framework and the way we talk about it is unique. It's exclusively specific to multi-location brands,
Okay.
right? So the way we look at
Right.
that 5-year framework doesn't apply to every business of every kind,
Right.
if that makes sense. There's a lot of
Yeah.
other frameworks that I've read books on and heard people talk about. There's a lot of different like 5 levels of success that are buried in within some of our gears, right? Like so I can think of several different frameworks that are well known and well used and well talked about in a million business books, which are talking about the 5 levels that you have to go through in what would be considered our first gear, right?
Okay.
So
Yeah.
from that in that proof of concept stage of getting that first 3 to 7 locations open in multiple markets, like there's a whole framework and level that all of the startup, people take brands through just to get through what we consider to be first gear. Very few brands will ever reach the place where they're even eligible to be our clients, right? If you look at the statistics on the number of businesses that start, the number of them that get to X size, the number of them to get to X amount of growth, at the end of the day, most businesses never make it to that point, right? And that's okay. It doesn't mean that it's bad, right? But that's the reality of it, which is actually, and that's one of the things that drew me to franchising, right? The statistics on franchising are pretty hard to ignore. Where you look at the success and failure rate of the average business, right? Where they talk about, hey, how many of them fail in the first year, the first 5 years, and you compare that to the success rate of the average franchise, and the numbers are massively different. I hate to quote, but I think the last stuff I saw from the IFA is some version of like, 20% of businesses fail in the first year, and like by year 5, 50% of them have failed, and like, you contrast that to franchising, and it's like 85% of franchises, make it to year 5 or something like that, right? So it's a pretty, pretty wild statistics to talk about why franchising is a wonderful path to success and a wonderful path to business ownership. So that's why I love the concept and I'm so passionate about it. And don't get me wrong, we still have some brands that we support that are still privately owned,
Sure.
and have grown, with nothing but corporate-owned stores. But I will tell you, I enjoy that. We do a great job of serving those clients. But on a personal level, I get way more excited about helping a bunch of franchisees. There's
Yeah.
just something about creating a bunch of successful small business owners, in as many communities in America as I can possibly create, that just gets me fired up. And although I really appreciate and have really enjoyed some of the experiences we've had growing some corporate businesses or some corporately owned, privately owned companies, there's some great experiences we've had there. There becomes a point with those brands that it gets pretty disconnected from the local communities, if that makes any sense.
So,
So.
what's like a good starting point then? Now I'm thinking about the person listening. They're enthralled with the song that you're singing, so to speak, and they've got some money, and they're like, "Oh, maybe that's my entry point." Which I don't know. For me, I love small business, so it's kind of like, "Hey, if we can get what's kind of a solid entry point?" Could you go as far as to say there's a particular franchise or that you find to be decent entry points or indicators that the person can use to find a good entry point franchise that has their best interest in mind? Because I've heard of some that take, 80% off like top line, and I'm like, I don't know,
That's
but that sounds insane.
I've never heard that. I would say I think most standard is like 3 to 7% of top line for royalty fees. I mean, it depends a lot on the different type of concept or whatnot. But the short answer to your question is, I'm not the right person to answer that, right?
Okay.
But there's an entire industry that is. There's an
Okay.
entire industry of what would be considered to be franchise consultants. I kind of think of them as like
Sure.
they're the buyer's agents of the franchising world. And it's a thriving industry of people that are passionate about helping individuals find the right franchise concept that fits their needs and is right for them and their families and all that kind of stuff, right? So
Okay.
That's a whole industry. We partner and work with obviously tons of organizations that that's their
Sure, sure,
focus
sure.
is is finding people that want to be business owners and want to own a franchisee, or are current business owners and want to own, you know, multiple franchise brands, and helping them walk through that, right? So there's lots of great resources out there for people that are in that position. You know, at the end of the day, our entry point, although that ends up being the majority of our work, is helping individual franchisees and franchisee organizations scale and open their businesses. Who we engage with first, most of the time, is the franchisor, because it's ultimately going, okay, you know, when you decide to franchise your business, right? So you've had success, you've got 10 really successful coffee shops, and you hit that point where you're like, man, you know, we have growth. The marketplace is telling us that, you know, they want what we have. We have opportunities to scale into other, you know, additional markets and growth and all that kind of stuff. But building that out corporately is really overwhelming. So there's a handful of reasons why people would choose the franchise model over just corporate growth, right? Most of them come down to the fact that it's a lot easier to raise capital. You know, it's a lot easier to get 100 people to each borrow $1 million than it is one person to come up with 100 million. That's so the capital requirements tend to be one of the first ones. But secondarily to that, and maybe not even secondarily, you know, operating locations with store managers versus operating locations with independent business owners that are committed to the success of that location ultimately is just a different way to grow the brand. And there's a lot of franchises that have proven that a bunch of independent business owners, you know, are going to create a much higher degree of success because they're all bought in and into creating their location's success, right? So, so that tends to be the crux of when somebody's going to do that. But when they get to that point where they're saying, "Hey, we want to start franchising our business and go down that path," there's again a lot of resources out there of, you know, law firms and private equity groups and other groups that will help brands make that transition, right? Where we tend to enter into the picture with brands is when they're like, okay, we've made this decision or we've started franchising the business, and they're answering that question and realization that, like, oh, franchising our business is actually a completely separate business than
I got
running our 10 coffee shops, right? And in that world, the customer is the franchisee, right? So when they look at that and they're now operating two separate businesses, that's where we end up coming into the picture, where they go, hey, we have to develop all the systems and ultimately then support the franchisees really well. And that's where we come into the picture, right? So we have a bunch of those frameworks, we have a bunch of those systems and tools where we can say, awesome, you're a brick and mortar franchise location. We've opened thousands and thousands of them at this point. We have made all the mistakes and seen all the mistakes, and we have a map for the minefield of navigating how we go about supporting the franchisees incredibly well in getting to that grand opening stage, right? So that's really where we get into, which is what we refer to as replicate success. So to tie that back, right? So the first step is the brand creating success? Do we have successful unit location economics? Do we know how to replicate that success? Do we know how to get, you know, new locations open, in a way that replicates the same success that we had in the first locations?
Can
Which
I
is a
throw you a
really
curveball?
sure,
I
100%.
wanted, so I want to kind of, so I w okay, so I've really enjoyed hearing this, and I could keep questioning down this, and you're really passionate. But jumping, I want to jump back originally to you talked about some business failures, and I had a question that prompted, and this is a beautiful curveball. It's a little bit
I love it.
unorthodox, but have you ever been bankrupt or close to it?
I have never filed bankruptcy. I have never filed bankruptcy. That is the answer to your question.
For audio
Have I?
only, we're doing a small applause because that's
Yeah,
unusual in some
that's right.
cases for success stories. So you talked about
Yeah.
those failures, and that's the guideline. What's the closest you've come?
Oh,
And what
yeah.
did that look like?
You know, that's a really great question, and I would say, you know, you know, I've received some counsel, and I've been told before that had I filed bankruptcy a couple of different times on a couple of different deals, I would probably be in a way better position today than I am, if I would have wiped out that stuff. But for whatever reason, I have felt compelled, to make good on any of the decisions I've made or people that I've brought to that, you know? And the truth is, yeah, that has absolutely been a challenge, right? You end up digging a big hole, and then you spend, you know, it's always interesting. It takes a lot less time to dig a hole than it does to fill it in, right? So I can think of a couple of different periods in my career where, you know, a bad year digs a hole, and then you spend the next 2 or 3 years just getting back to zero, right? So, and there's been two major times in my business where I feel like that has been the case. One of those prompted years ago our decision to stop chasing work with, you know, the Fortune 500 companies and publicly traded companies, right? So we were working with some really big clients, because they found us, and it turns out that the service we provide really helps that. But at the end of the day, what we realized is, you know, those guys aren't doing it for the same reason we are, right? I like to say we're in the business of helping small business owners be successful. We're not in the business of helping procurement people get promotions, right? Like, that's not what we do. And that doesn't really fit well in Fortune 500 publicly traded America, right? So we found that those aren't our clients, right? And the great news is there's a bunch of people that are super happy to go chase that business, and they can all race to zero. We don't need to participate in that race. But candidly speaking, you know, I took a 600, it was a $600,000 lesson 1 year that taught me that, right? Because we had one of our big publicly traded clients, did go bankrupt, right? So they did file for bankruptcy, and we got stuck holding the bag on some of that kind of stuff because we were supposed to open 90 stores for them, over the next 2 years, and instead it turned into, you know, we only opened 11. So anyway, that was a fun educational experience. And it would have been a lot easier. It would have been easy, according to all the accountants, for me to be like, "Oh, we made a mistake. We didn't realize we weren't protected." And we believed what, you know, we believed what this giant telecom company told us. So shame on us. But it should be our vendors and our suppliers and our banking partners that should pay for that, not us. And at the end of the day, I was just like, man, I'm not comfortable with that, right? So it took a lot of years to work ourselves back into a position. And what that looks like is saying no to opportunities that would have been fantastic opportunities, but there were opportunities that, you know, for the couple of years following that, we weren't able to take advantage of or pursue, right? So it talks about focus and all those things, right? And I think that's part of the lessons. And I don't know, time will prove whether or not I am smart or stupid. I've had people argue both ways. You know, there's a reason why America's built the way it is, and we have a bankruptcy system because it encourages, you know, innovation
Well,
and risk-taking.
why did
But
you feel compelled? And I'm not disagreeing with you. It's just I feel like as the host, my questions should be more geared toward understanding. And I loved how you answered that because it indicated a significant degree of internal perspective
struggle.
that said struggle that says this might be somebody else's path, and maybe there's nothing wrong with that, but this is my path.
Yeah, I think it's hard for me in that, it's hard for me. I mean, candidly, if there was a world that existed that the people that were at fault were the ones that could pay the bill, you know, if that's how our bankruptcy process worked, then I would be all for that. But unfortunately, that's not the way it works, right? It works that a bunch of people that, you know, that weren't necessarily the ones that had anything to do with it are the ones that end up getting the shaft, right? So in our world, you know, in our world, the way that looked like was, you know, we have hundreds of suppliers and vendors that we rely on to be successful to do what we do, right? So, you
So
know,
you wanted the buck to stop with you instead of going on to
right.
your partners.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's like, it's not their fault. Right. So, now, and there were a handful of them, and candidly speaking, there were some vendors where we went and told that story to, and we said, look, here's what's going to happen. You can, right. Like, you can allow us to pay, you know, it's like, you can allow us to pay you back over time.
Right.
And believe
You
that
can
we're going to
force
commit to
us
doing
into
that.
bankruptcy or,
Or,
yeah.
and we had to, with our top handful of suppliers, we had to go have that meeting. It was convenient. In fairness, it's easier to have that meeting when all they have to do is look at the news and be like, oh yeah, this is a crappy situation. And we recognize and can see that. So in fairness, I think that would be, our hand was forced on that issue and on that one specifically. So I think that's a little bit of an easier one to have that conversation with, where we can be like, well, we were making the best decisions that we could with the information we had. And obviously, this was a surprise to all of us. So how do we work out of this? And we had vendors that support us in that, right? We were just, I'm like, so here's what I want to do. I want to pay you back over time. So I need you guys to help me through this. And we had one vendor. We had one vendor that decided to be a jerk. And that was really frustrating. And it wasn't even, and ironically, it wasn't even a large, it wasn't even, and it was one of the smallest ones. That's always the funny part about it, right? And other than that, everyone else was just like, awesome, we believe in what you guys are doing and we're here for it. So let's help you guys work through that. And that's been a long time ago now, right? It's crazy to go back to that time now, because that was a, I mean, it was a hard couple of years, right? It was a rough couple of years of working through that, and sacrificing in a million different ways, both personally and as an organization, for us to make it right with all the vendors that were part of that deal.
Well, then
So that was what that
what's
amounts to.
worse about that hole? I mean, that hole looks like a rocket one day, right? I mean,
Yeah.
correct me if I'm wrong. 99 stores, big account, the rocket's going. 12 stores already opened. We are on our way to the moon, right? And then overnight, it sounds like no warning, or if there was, you're not supposed to, but you lose the
Well,
wing.
and this is all really super public record now, right? So the challenge that we dealt with was, so we were engaged to build stores for all the Sprint dealers. Right, so we were helping all the Sprint dealers open stores, and the challenge was, is outside of what we were doing with that, with Sprint's growth and helping all these independent dealers grow and open stores, Sprint had gone and done a joint venture with another group, to build out and operate all the Radio Shack stores, if anybody remembers this, right? So what went
Okay.
bankrupt was the joint
I do
venture,
remember
right? What
this.
went under was the joint venture between Sprint and this group that were operating these Radio Shacks, which had
Yeah.
nothing to do with all of the dealers that we were helping open stores for. But when that bankruptcy happened, or that failure happened, the Sprint made the corporate decision to stop all growth, right? Which in, because they needed to
Right.
stop the bleeding, right? Like, they had to stop the bleeding. They had to reset their business and figure that
Right.
out. Now, we all know what ultimately came to the, out of that, right? What ultimately came out of that was the Sprint T-Mobile merger, which is an interesting topic of conversation for a lot of people. But ultimately, that was the outcome, and we know that now, right? So, but at the time, it was really hard, because what we got told was, oh well, hey, we're hitting pause on all of the franchisee store openings. So, those 12 stores were ones that were like basically in construction, where they were past the point of no return. So they allowed those to open. But then what you dealt with was all of those guys that had growth plans over those next several years were told, nope, no growth plans. Well, they knew that the reason for that was, well, this is the nail in the coffin, so to speak, that's going to have to totally change our business, which it did. And it ultimately resulted in the merger with them and T-Mobile. But, and so the last thing they needed to do was add a bunch of Sprint stores to the map during the
Yeah.
year or two leading up to that, right? So ultimately, that's what that amounted to. So that's what was really hard, right? So we had all these independent business owners, all these Sprint dealers, who they had growth plans. They were opening stores, they were growing their businesses. And that's who we had commitments from to help open those locations. Well, the rug got pulled out from underneath them, right? And so then by, guilty by association, the rug also got pulled out from underneath us, right? So
So,
because fun, yeah.
you and I have talked before. Were you working with your wife at this point? Kind of tell me about that relationship, because
Oh,
I
sure.
want to catch that up to this bankruptcy.
Yeah, absolutely. So
Or
it's
pardon
interesting. I
me,
mean, that's
near for you to, sorry, the bankruptcy that wasn't yours that you decided to help shoulder.
100%. So the answer to your question is, Katie was involved at the business by that time. So she had joined not long before that, actually.
Oh,
She
wow.
had came into the business part time.
Okay.
Now she's been around since the birth of the business, right? So she had been around since
Sure.
the birth of the business. She has a finance and accounting background. Actually was working in accounting for K-State University after she graduated, and then when we had moved to Kansas City and moved the company to Kansas City, she was working with a group that did consulting for veterinary clinics all over the country. So, perfect, perfect, super applicable. But she was doing financial consulting and helping with all these small business owners. And so, as our business was growing, I was like, man, I really need some help with this. We had tried to hire a couple of people that didn't work out, and so
Okay.
ultimately, I'm like, I need you to come in and lead this. Get everything squared away and get our systems in place so that we can hire somebody, 6 months to a year, come in and get it cleaned up and we'll get it figured out and you can keep your other clients.
Part-time and
So
temporary.
yeah, that was the deal, honey. I'm like, yeah, it'll be like, yeah, it'll be great. You're gonna love it. So ultimately she came in and over time as the business grew, it just became incredibly apparent that it was just like, man, we want to do this together. She wanted to be involved in it, right? It's our family's legacy. I would tell you the Sprint deal and what we went through with that kind of cemented that, right? Because now we're in this really, really difficult situation, so hiring somebody to come in and navigate that for us versus us navigating it was a real, that would have been a very, very hard thing. So that really kind of cemented her in the business. It was years later that she finally, so she kind of backed off and we became her only client. And she became a full-time employee of Catalyst. And that's been a lot of years now. But backing up further than that, she grew up on a farm and in a farming, ranching family in Northwest Kansas. I grew up with, both my grandparents were farmers and ranchers. My parents farmed and ranched until the eight when I was a little kid until the 80s when farming and ranching when they went through their big, if anybody remembers 1986. I barely do, but I've heard a lot of the stories. And so they lost the farm, metaphorically and literally, back in the mid-80s, and went different paths and had different businesses after that. So we both grew up working in a world where family worked together, right? So because that's what that world looks like, right? Like family works together on the farm. They're family
Yeah.
businesses. Because it's not a career, it's a lifestyle, right? Like you talk about a family's lifestyle, not a family farm. One of the biggest things that I get so frustrated with is listening to all these people that talk about work-life balance. That is the biggest load of crap one of the biggest lies that we have talked about as a society, right? Like work-life balance. Like, why would you separate what you spend half of your awake hours doing from your life, right? Like
I
work-life
don't think
balance
we
is
want that
BS.
either.
No, you
I
want
don't think we
work-life
want that.
integration. Right? Like you want what you do to
To have meaning.
support. It makes no sense to me, right? And so it cracks me up, and we've got all these, now there's all these proponents talking about people want purpose. There's, one of the biggest TED Talks in the world is Simon Sinek starts with why and all these other things, right? People want purpose and meaning, and they want to do something that matters and be part of something bigger than themselves and all those things. So in why on earth would you want to separate that from your personal life? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, right? So I grew up where family business was normal. Work-life integration was the goal. Does that make sense? Was how do you build a life where work and family and hobbies and all that stuff ultimately build on one another and create a lifestyle that you and your family want to live? So
And did
I can
Katie have
also
a
tell you,
similar upbringing then, too? Because
yeah,
that you
100%.
were
Yeah,
talking
she grew
about,
up as a
okay. So
She
you
grew up in
both kind
farming
of
and
grew up
ranching, and
in that world where it's like we're working together anyway.
so it was never foreign. It was never a foreign concept to us, and we saw it modeled. We both have lots of examples of watching it modeled incredibly healthy, and we have plenty of examples of watching it modeled completely unhealthy.
Oh, sure.
Which, by the way, is no different than all the people that have worked for somebody else that haven't worked with family, right? Every one of us have experiences of, coworkers and coworking relationships and bosses and managers and all the things. We all know what healthy and unhealthy looks like, right? So What I can tell you is with our family and with our son also knows what it looks like for mommy and daddy to be focused on the same goals and for us to have shared dreams and for us to be working towards the same missions. And that was a world that we both grew up in. So it seemed natural for us, but it's also a world that we intentionally wanted to create for our family and our son, right? Like, I love the fact that my wife and I get to chase the same dreams every day. I love the fact that we get to work towards those things and we have that partnership. I don't love the fact that I haven't always been the husband and CEO that I want to be because sometimes the emotions of family get in the way of working together, right? So it's definitely not perfect. It's different. But I love the fact that I can't imagine doing it differently, if that makes
Well,
any
and I
sense.
feel
So.
like so then to kind of fast forward, I feel like so to you bring her on, she's consulting part-time under the notion that she's gonna kind of get out, and now the rug's been pulled out from underneath you. I feel like if there were any challenges that would have presented themselves, they would have presented themselves in the apex of that moment, if I had to guess. So can you walk me through, and she has access to the books.
She is
So
my
that's what I
controller, both
heard.
literally and
Right,
metaphorically, right? So, yeah,
right.
100%.
So let's
So,
talk about what, and we had talked about before this. If I had to guess, you're a little bit more of an optimist. She's a little bit more of a realist, fair, right?
Fair,
With
yes.
book access. And that's just all great things. But now tell me about those arguments.
Yeah, 100%. Well, it's interesting. I think the comment I mentioned to you beforehand is we complement each other incredibly well, right? Like, I tend to trust people until they give me a reason not to. She tends not to trust people until they give her 10 reasons to, right? So that's kind of how we approach that world, which is why she's the right
Why it
person in the
works.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And she's in a seat that she is successful at too, right? Does that make
Yeah.
sense? So
Right.
That's what you want in a controller. That's what you want in your head of finance, right? So
100%.
you want somebody that fundamentally doesn't trust anything or anyone. That makes
Well, it's
them
the
really good
person
at their
that
job.
catches
Frustrates the hell out
fraud.
of everybody, but
Well.
absolutely is the right. But that's the point, right? That's the job. That is actually the job.
Yeah.
So, and
100%.
she does it incredibly well. And I really, really appreciate that. And it also, and I got to tell you, there's a massive luxury that comes with having somebody that oversees that part of your business that you trust explicitly, right? It allows me to do my job better because there's so many things that I don't have to worry about whether or not we're making the right decisions related to the millions of different little decisions that have to get made every day in that world. Now, I will tell you, I know lots of business owners that have a partner or an employee that it's in that role that serves that function, and they have that same luxury and that same level of trust, and or they have systems that allow for their appropriate checks and balances and all the things that go along with that, all of which
But the
we also have.
difficulties,
But it was easier to get.
we agree this is the I agree that this is the it sounds like the ideal personality for the ideal role, and it's perfect. And I'm not trying to zero in on her. I'm just more curious because I wanted to get the family dynamic as we were talking about, and to kind of rewind a little bit, as because what solidified it for me was you talked about difficult vendor conversations that transparently I've had. This was relatable to me. There were vendors through a series through a similar situation where we had decided it made the most sense to push forward and not declare bankruptcy. And so, and what I was trying to, and my wife had was very, very supportive, but not quite. I mean, she wasn't involved to the same end. I don't think. Although arguably she was. I'm not going to discount any of that. So I'm trying to understand. Like, tell me about some of those conversations. Tell me about the moment. Tell me about. Did she know immediately? Did she know first? Did she come to you and
Oh,
was
she knew
like, "Oh,
first.
by the
Oh, yeah,
way"?
she knew. Well, I mean, okay. I mean, the answer is yeah, she knew and
Is
really
she telling
understood a lot of
you
that stuff. Oh,
the
yeah,
rocket got
100%.
clipped?
Well, I mean, obviously we knew it on the sales side of our business long before we before we saw it, right? Because at the end of the day, accounting is, I talk a lot about this, right? Like the accounting function of a business is the rear view mirror, right? And there's a reason why the rear view mirror is this big and the windshield is this, is huge. But really good accounting tells you what happened, and a really good controller tells you why it happened, right? But ultimately at the end of the day, it's all rear facing. Right. So financial forecasting is a completely different, it's really a completely different thing. But,
It's so
and is,
tough too, because
yeah.
that analogy, it's interesting. I'm just the clarity brought from the rear view mirror
Well, it's
versus
dangerous to
the
drive without mirrors.
vastness, 100%, versus the vastness of data in the windshield that's like
Right.
financial forecasting. Great, yeah, we're talking about a rocket that got its wings clipped. So,
Right.
anyway,
I
sorry.
would definitely say, I mean, don't get me wrong. You can do a podcast with her and she can tell you whether or not her experience was that she was excited about taking ownership over some of those things or whether she felt like she was trapped. Right. Like there's an argument of like, why are we so close? Well, it was trauma bonding. No, I don't, there's definitely some truth to that. I can definitely
Financial
tell you that this.
codependency.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, there is some level of, her taking ownership over that because it's hers as much as it's mine, right? As it relates to the outcome. Right. So we're in this together. We go, if we go down as a team. So we might as well go up as a team, right? So at the end of the
Yeah.
day, I can definitely tell you, and this is a conversation her and I have had. It was definitely through that process and through those years of working out with that the business became ours and not mine, right? So in the early days of the business and in those early years, it was very much, Catalyst was my business. Like she had her business and I had my business, right? And Catalyst was mine. It was my dream. It was my business. And she was helping me with it, right? Through that process, it was super fun. And we've talked about, it felt gradual at the time. As we've talked about it historically, we can kind of put some key markers in place as to when, that experience, and then coupled by COVID and the experience we all went had, we all went through going through the COVID stuff, which would be the next closest time we ever got to bankruptcy, by the way. That was the other story, but that's a story that a lot of people can relate to. Which I will tell you, I'm convinced that we succeeded through COVID and that we made it through COVID the way we did and as healthy as we did with the least amount of damages we did because we had made it through that horrible
The
event
first
years
one.
earlier. It
Yeah,
prepped
your
us so that when we went
shift.
through COVID, we actually knew, we're like, we've done this before. We know how to get through this and let's not make the same mistakes twice. So
Well,
we were
plus you
actually
had
able to
made a
navigate COVID.
shift. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but your shift in clientele couldn't have hurt, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, yes, and we didn't have we had a more diverse clientele when we went into COVID, which did help us because but most of our clients grew during COVID or at least during 20 and 2021. So we had a lot of clients that actually had some really great growth during that time. And so the fact that we were a little more diversified, and that was super purposeful because we learned what happens, when your largest client is too big and they have a problem, right? So we were really sensitive to not replicate that again. So we
Well, these
were
are the
very
same clients
intentionally more diversified, right?
that hit. They're massive, right? Those are the clients that hit pause. Those are the clients that can't pivot. Those are the clients that are
That's right.
making mergers and acquisitions at a massive scale because of a significant change in revenue. That just from versus the scrappy individuals at gears two,
That's it.
three. You know what I mean? That are
All the
okay. Crap happened. How do we pivot? How do we what's
That's right.
stage two?
There were
And
thousands and thousands of families' fortunes and family wherewithal at risk in all of these franchise brands when COVID hit. So they were all super motivated to figure out how to find a way through that, how to pivot their business, adjust their business, grow, change, whatever. And the fact that we were a support structure for them, we got the benefit and the privilege being able to help be one of the tools in the toolbox of all of these thousands of small business owners that said, no, I'm going to innovate, I'm going to adjust, I'm going to adapt, I'm going to update, right? And level up during that period of time, right? Which that's the spirit of entrepreneurship. That's the spirit of small business ownership, right? So,
I love how
and
much of an optimist you are. And
yeah.
then it's well, because what I heard to kind of summarize too is from a familial side, the first event cemented the relationship with regards to the business and brought it closer. While there were
Now, don't get,
difficulties, obviously,
yeah, don't get
that
me
was the
wrong.
result of that.
The outcome is a wonderful story. I will tell you,
I'm
I'm sure
trying
the
to talk too,
psychologists
though.
could
I'm
tell
trying to
us
get at
about,
what are those
yeah, I'm
moments of
trying.
like, let's pack up shop. Did you ever have that? Did you ever like, let's call it in.
Yeah.
This is it. Time to, pivot or quit or whatever. I don't know.
The joke that we've made, which is a joke o only in name because it's not a joke at all. It's very real, right? So the joke we always had was, hey, look, it's going to work as long as we both don't quit on the same day. Right? Like, so that's the power of that, right? It's like we just can't both quit on the same day and we're going to be fine and we're going to make it to the other side, right? I think that's exactly true. Now, that said, and I want to be clear, Katie and I, we're talking about Katie and I, we have two other members of our executive team, that over the that are partners in our business today, and that are just, if not more so, part of the story of that success and making it through that. So, in on top of the fact that Katie and I aren't alone, and we feel like partners in this, we also have a team of people, right? So that's the other thing, right? Like, it's a team effort to do what we're doing. None of us could do it alone in any way. Like, you can't make it through that alone. And I don't know how people do. So there's a, I think there's a Bible verse that talks about the difference between trying to do it by yourself versus what happens when like three people get together and do it, right? Like this isn't a new concept,
For some
in
reason,
human in humanity.
the verse to me that comes to mind is the oxen. One ox can push like 100 pounds or something, or I don't remember what it is, but two ox can do like 10,000. It's when plowing the same direction. So you're
That's
100%
it.
right. Don't ask me what verse that is. So bad. Sounds cool that I remember one, but I don't know which
For
one
sure. And to that point, so I
it
think
is.
that's the, so Katie and I are also, we have other team members that that I can't imagine doing this without too. And when COVID happened, that's something that I will tell people, right? That I mean, I remember the meet we had the meeting, we had the meeting the day after the world shut down with COVID. Amongst the four of us, our executive team, our part the partnership group, and we got together and said,
Was that like
what are we
March
doing here?
20th? Yeah,
Yeah, whatever,
something
right? It
like
was just
that.
like, the first day was calling all of our clients and, wiping out our entire, millions of dollars in our sales pipeline and going, yep, okay, all of our clients have no idea what they're going to do. So that means everything's on hold. What are we going to do? Right? Like, and I will tell you that conversation fundamentally came out of it. We had that conversation as a group, and it was, if we're all in, we're all in. But if one of us isn't in, then none of us are in, right? Like, the only way we do this is if we're all in and gonna go through it together and do it together. And that's what we did, which was an amazing, and I would definitely say, you want to talk about some hard years and hard conversations and hard decisions and sacrifice on, a million different personal, professional, and otherwise levels,
When
to get to the other side of that.
I got a call back. You've made a couple good references, actually. What, but the one that I got to call out this one because so Jim Starcev, I interviewed him. He was a couple episodes ago. He had a partnership, 50-50 split, and the one of the vehicles to it working, it sounded like, was if any one of the two partners didn't want to do something, they had a veto right at any point. And that veto they just wouldn't do it. So to your point, we're either all in it or we're all not. It's a callback in my mind to that. And that's a very interesting concept because to me, once I hear it, it's like, oh, duh, of course that's going to work. And yet, if you don't hear it, right? How many are forcing dynamics and
Right.
power
And I would definitely
struggles?
say, well, and what set me up to be able to lead in that way and navigate that was definitely the success of my first business partnership. I had an equal partner. We had a 50-50 partnership with my first business partner, and when we built the retail stores out, and that's how we operated, right? We operated in a way where it was essentially it was equal partnership, again, equally yoked. I don't know how you I guess probably there's a principle there. So we talk about like, hey, we have this equal partnership, and that's exactly kind of how we operated, right? Is like we had veto rights, right? So, and where at the end of the day, we got to the point where we grew that business to where we understood our lanes and the things that we were each responsible for, and we learned how to get to that point where to understand these are the conversations that and these are the decisions, right? We all understood, hey, these are decisions that fall under my authority, and my responsibility is based on the role I play in the organization. But then as partners and as, essentially as shareholders, right? What are those decisions that need to raise up to that level? And and unfortunately the reality is you learn how to do that the way you learn how to make good decisions by making bad decisions. Right? You learn like that's the unfortunate truth of that. Does that make sense? So it's like you learn which ones are the right ones to bring up. And sometimes you learn that by somebody not doing that.
No, it makes a ton
But
of
I was
sense. I
really
mean,
blessed.
I heard the reference once and I just, it stuck with me. If you want to increase your level of successes, increase your level of failures.
Correct. That's
And
exactly right. But
so,
how do we mitigate? How do we make the failures not hurt as badly? Right? And how do we, right? And how do we make sure that we're using the things we learned to not I love failure because you fail, right? You win or you learn. You win or you learn. You win or you learn. And so I am, it's super easy for me to embrace failure once. I am like, oh, we found a new way to fail. That is awesome. We failed the same way again. That tends to make me cranky. Right? Like, I'm all
We've been
about
here
making new
before.
mistakes, but let's not make the same ones over and over, right? Like, that's how do we mitigate that? So, but that's definitely the case. And so anyway, but the fact that I had that partnership, and it was a great partnership. By the end of that business, we had another minority partner who was my dad. So in our first business, we were scaling that business up. We needed resources we didn't have. And me and my equal business partner actually brought my dad into our business. As a minority owner to help us execute. And that was amazing. And so I got the privilege of working with my dad during that time for a while, with another partner. So again, that family business just, and it probably won't shock you, my business partner that helped me run those retail stores grew up on a farm in North Central Kansas, right? Like, so, right. I don't know. There's a common thread there, right? Of like, that upbringing and that, what I will tell you, I understand today is, right, the corporate speak way to explain that is, we have a very aligned set of core values, right? So it was great to, I had a wonderful partnership for a decade. He's still one of my closest friends today. And that wonderful partnership was based on a similar set of core values, incredibly aligned set of core values. We didn't know how to say it that way back then, but it was true. And I think it's what attracted us together when we got in business together, because we actually didn't really know each other that well when we got in business together, right? So we were coworkers. We originally intended on having more partners in that business, and when the rubber met the road, so to speak, we were the only two that showed up and actually decided to jump ship and go do our own thing. And so it was just the two of us, which is a story for a different day. But
Can you speak to, do you have, we're going to get back into corporate speak now, but
sure.
it's, I'm just curious, do you have a clear model for ensuring corporate value alignment, and what does that look like when hiring
Oh,
someone?
here today in our organization today. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's
So,
help somebody else out that's in that
love
transition
it.
of like, hey,
How do you do culture on
How do we,
purpose?
let's even go as far as to say, I'm talking to somebody that maybe I want to be a partner, and shoot, if I can borrow from Tate's
100%.
entire structure,
Well, the you know, there's a million different frameworks, consultants, books, and all that kind of stuff that will tell
There
you that
is
this is
a,
the way
aren't
to do
there?
it. And I don't disagree.
EOS.
EOS
Yeah,
is
yeah.
a great
There's
example.
20 different
I
personality tests that require two
right.
different consultants to read.
Right,
Yep.
100%. So all of those things,
Modern
and
mediums in some cases, sometimes it seems like, right?
yeah,
Just like,
that's it.
let's
So
bring the witch in and
yeah, exactly. You nailed it, right? Like, how do we know, right? Like, we're gonna read the bones, and we're gonna, it's like light the plants on fire and do all the things, right? So
Oh, they didn't succeed? Clearly, the bones fell
clearly,
this way. You had to have known it was going to happen. That
how did
rearview
you not know?
mirror, the clarity,
That's it.
hindsight.
So you have to get, and I would say, as the leader of an organization, an entrepreneur and a business owner, if there's any skill that you have to develop, that's the one, right? That is the skill of discernment, right? And the ability to understand first off, but it's first off, you have to do discovery, right? Core values are not aspirational. That's one of the biggest things and biggest mistakes we see people make. And I've talked to a million different business owners. They talk about what their core values are. And I was like, oh, really? Those are your core values? That's fascinating. And
I
because
don't
they're
see
aspirational.
that. Right.
Yeah.
This is your walk. I should be able to
Right.
see what you do and go, these must be your core values.
Which is ultimately, we've solidified our core.
Well, that's fun.
Oh,
Can you
did
still
they
hear
die on
me?
you? I can hear you. You're good. It switched over to, hey, it works. Just changing audio. That's okay. Your headset died. No big deal. We're rolling with it. So the core values. I'm intrigued. I'm on the edge of my seat here for some
Yeah,
reason.
so core values at the end of the day, we went through a multi-year process of discovery and refinement as to what our organization's core values really were. Obviously, it starts with the founder, right? The core values can't be like, I have to embody them. They have to be mine, right? If the
Yes,
founder and the
right.
organization doesn't embody the core values, then it's impossible for them to be successful.
Your ethos, I think, is the term for that. Yeah.
So it has to be a, I have to embody them. And ultimately so does the rest of the leadership team for us to be successful. And so we spent a lot of time figuring out, we had enough traction and enough age and enough size that when we went through that discovery process, we had enough winning game film to review to actually answer the question, well, what are our core values, right? Not what do we want them to be, what are they? And I think simpler is better. And I believe that aspirational core values or permission to play values don't really have any place, right? So you want to
Like
weed through,
integrity or honesty.
right? Other than, ironically, one of our core values is that we do what we say we're going to do. Which we've had people ask, like, well, isn't that just honesty? And it's like, well, yeah. And they're like, well, how is that? That feels like a permission to play thing. And it's like, well, understand that fundamentally we are construction adjacent, right? So we integrate deeply with the construction industry, and unfortunately, doing what you say you're going to do,
No, and I think
what you
that's,
say
I
you're going to do
do.
is an incredibly unique characteristic in the construction
Well,
industry.
because what that says is if you run into a situation where you can't do what you say you're going to do, you're going to find a way, even at the cost of yourself in some situations, to make it happen.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Through that discovery process, that's one of our core values. And over the years, there's a ton of different tools out there. And I've tried a bunch of different frameworks. We have questions that we ask. We do all those other things, but fundamentally, at the end of the day,
So what I'm hearing is so basically the number one tool to hiring people or finding partners is understanding what makes up your core values as a person, your ethos that you want the business, the entity, the baby that you're in to embody in such a way that you can filter hires and partnerships through that lens.
That's exactly right. So, and ultimately it has to be the ones that are ideal, they're the ones that are the differentiators too, right? That's that permission to play thing is to your point, right? Like, if integrity is, one of your
We
core
hire a
values,
bunch of liars around here.
right? So it's like, what, you hire a bunch of liars? Like, that's weird, right? So that's,
Wolf
so
on Wall
brands like,
Street over in this
yeah,
joint.
exactly. Yeah, there's a world that exists where integrity might be an incredibly unique core value in a specific market, right? I can think of a couple.
Sure. But your average market. Yeah, I agree.
But your average market, integrity is not a unique core value, right?
You better have it.
So I think that's one of those things, and aspirational ones where you're not, where it's not your real core values, right? So at the point in time, so my point to this is, once you've done the discovery to determine what they actually are, it becomes a whole lot easier to find alignment with people, and seek out whether or not they have them, right? So, we ran with four for a long time. Eventually we figured out a better way to say it, where two of them ended up kind of rolling together. And today we have three core values that we talk a lot about: hire, fire, and reward by. And we try to build that into a lot of our different conversations and a lot of the different stuff that we do. It is not the only, this is the other mistake that I learned the hard way. It is not the only qualification for someone to get employed or to have a role. It is one of the three qualifications, right? Because at the end of the day, you have to be the right person, you have to have the right skills and knowledge, and you have to, and you have to embody the core values most of the time, right? Those are the three, right? Those are the three questions. That's the three things you have to answer, right? So the skills and knowledge is
So say
unique.
that again, be the right person, in which case my mind was values, but it would.
In our world, I talk about that much more so in, you mentioned like all the different lessons you can take. So we use, I'm a big believer in behavioral psychology and understanding, right? So personality profile, behavioral testing, there's a million different ones that you can use. A lot of them are fundamentally based on the same science.
And
We've
your
been
favorite one is?
we use predictive index. So I'm a big fan of
Okay.
predictive index. We used a
Okay.
variation of different DISC tools for years.
Okay.
Predictive index is a, right, they're in similar family.
Okay.
There's other good ones out there, right? The best tool is the
Culture
one.
index is the one that comes up a lot,
Yeah,
it seems like.
100%. So, but that's where, understanding those tools and understanding the, within the different roles of the business and on the different teams, there are behavioral profiles, right, where people are naturally wired in a certain way, right? Like they're, God made them this way, right? And so they, so understanding like what that is, right? And making sure that you're not asking, it's about setting people up for success and not failure.
100%. An extreme introvert in the role of sales,
It,
which
that's
funnily enough, Jim Starcev was. So if you want an alternative view, that would be a good. But in general, and this is what I tell other people, because I'm like, yes, I agree it's possible, but we can agree that in general, if we're playing statistics, which we kind of are, we
Right.
probably don't want an extremely introverted salesperson.
And what I've learned is maturity and self-awareness can allow somebody to work
Overcome.
outside of their natural behaviors, right? And the
If they
level of
really
maturity and
want to.
self-awareness they have will extend the period of time that they can do that. But at the, in a best case scenario, someone is going to end up unfulfilled, right? That's the best case scenario, is a lack of fulfillment, right? Like they're just not going to be happy doing it, because we aren't happy manipulating and molding who we are against how we are naturally wired, right? Like we can only do that for so long before, at best case, we're just not happy. At worst case, there's a lot of other consequences that come along with it. Does that make sense? Right. So,
So be the person. We're talking about personality tests and ways to potentially gauge that. Self-awareness is something to look for. And then have the skill set. Obviously, that's kind of resume and testing and
100%, right? And
and
that's unique
then
to every position in the
core
organization. And that's
value.
also the one that you can change, right? We can teach skills and knowledge, right? So that's the one that we can actually adjust, right? So if someone needs to increase their skills and knowledge, that's called growth. That's called education. That's called training, right? So the one as an organization that we can affect is skills and knowledge, right? So you have to have a clear understanding of what skills and knowledge do we need in this role, in this thing that we, right? So we have to have clarity about what we're asking somebody to do, right? So then we can understand, okay, well, what
Sorry, it's
behavioral
crazy to me.
patterns are
I'm
likely.
realizing, I'm pretty sure this is ethos, pathos, and logos. I'm pretty sure
Probably.
that's just, that's what you nailed. That's
Yeah.
their moral compass,
Yep.
who they are as a person, and what they're capable of, their logos, their knowledge,
Sure.
their logic, and I'm just
Yeah,
fascinating to me.
It's amazing how everything is new again, right? Like all it's
Right. Yeah.
this is there's just fundamental truths, right? We can call these things, we can use whatever framework and we can use whatever name and language
Sure.
and all that stuff.
Right.
At the end of the day, there's fundamental frameworks and fundamental truths that have been true for a really long time, right? So
Latin, Greek, biblical. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and
whatever
then
you
it
want.
just it once you find it. And then what's so interesting to me too, we talk about making mistakes. How many times have we read a book, literally had the information right in front of us, made the mistake anyway, learned the lesson, reread the book, and we're like, "Ah." And
That's what that
I'll
meant.
throw myself under the bus here. When I first started Solopreneur, thought Traction EOS was a load of crock.
Yeah, oh, it's a great system.
When you start hiring people and you're like, who's next? Maybe
Right.
that's a pretty good book. When you start to disconnect from different elements of the business and hear Traction is talking about rocks and reviews, and maybe that's a pretty good book, right? And so, to that end, sometimes it isn't the information you get, it's when you get
Yeah, that my dad always used to have a saying. He said,
it.
and I'm sure he stole it from somewhere, and I have no idea where he stole it from. Somebody can Google this and tell us. But he talked a lot about, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear, right? So there's which is a saying that's been around for a long time, I think. And I remember being younger and not understanding what the heck he meant by that. And I definitely would say probably one of the easiest examples that I've recognized that is exactly what you just said, where I've reread a book. And I'm like, I read this book before and that wasn't in there last time. I'm sure that wasn't in there last time. And the answer is, well, it was, but I didn't have ears to hear it, right? Like I didn't have perspective. I didn't have an understanding of how to apply that knowledge in my business or in my life or in my family or in my whatever, right? So the answer is, right, like that's which is really all that that means, right? If we don't have a way to relate that information or a perspective that gives us that, right? We don't have a way to apply it. It's really hard to hear. Right, that's the reality. So, anyway.
We have a whole motto here that it's kind of the motto kind of started, and we've been filtering a lot of the core values through it. And the motto is, and it goes back to your dad, you said your dad maybe stole it from somewhere. It's if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants, which we stole from Isaac Newton, who said, if I have
Yes.
seen further, who stole from a priest or a cleric, who stole from Greek mythology, and
Right.
it's this notion of continue to be a student, right? Which you could still have moments of, oh, that's a load of crock. And then you find, no, it wasn't. I just wasn't in. And then recognize that some of your original thoughts maybe weren't so original. But
Yeah.
also, that's, and we have people to thank for that.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
So
there's
I'm going to
lots.
end on then. I think if we can start to, I think we should probably start to transition for you there. Make sure
Sure.
you get your stuff going. Let's start with who's a giant, who's been a giant for you? And then that's a new one that I'll ask you.
Ooh, that's such a hard one. I mean, my mom and dad were definitely massive influences in my life. I feel like I'm the perfect combination of the two of them in a lot of ways, which is how it should be, right? So I got a lot from my mom and a lot from my dad, and they were amazing human beings and helped a lot of people out. They were both were, and my dad still is. My mom's passed, but my dad is still a small business owner, and so I think that's so I definitely got a lot of my love from them. And love of entrepreneurship and love of freedom and love of those things. I watched them chase dreams together. And so that was, it's hard for me not to give them the credit, because really everyone else, is a every I've had so many amazing mentors and friends and peers in my life over all these years. And as amazing as all of them were, none of them had the influence that my parents did, which I realize is not a profound statement, right? But I consider myself super blessed and super lucky, to have gone through that. And I watched my parents go through struggles and success, right? My parents, had a lot of businesses that weren't wildly successful, and they had some that were, moderately successful. And I watched them put in that work and put in that effort and do that together. And so I wasn't, I wasn't. I wasn't cast into the world with a family office and a big pile of money that I got to go play with. but I was launched into the world with an amazing set of values and an amazing work ethic and an understanding and appreciation and empathy and love for humans and for people and for freedom. And so that is the thing that I ultimately really, really appreciate from them. I also would say that, I watched my parents have mentors. And so that built for me an understanding that part of the path is going and checking the fruit on the tree and finding people that, find the people that have done it longer and bigger than you and go learn from them and go talk to them. And I've been lucky enough to have some people that have been willing to give me their time and knowledge and attention, even when I didn't deserve it, right? So, and I am super, super grateful of that. So, yeah.
What's been something you've taken with you, you've learned that just again and again and again rings true?
As in, what's the mistake that I've made over and over again?
What's helped you the most, right? What's that lesson that was either taught or learned that just it's you filtered decisions through it the most?
Man, that's a hard one. The
I'm sorry. I know there's always so many. We try to distill it down to one thing, and it never really
I
is,
know
is it?
one,
But
it's
what's the
so
one that
hard.
comes up regularly?
I think the biggest challenge regularly is learn, that there's an old, well, I think the biggest one is, the old adage, hire slow and fire fast. People talk about that, right? Like, so I think probably the hardest lesson I've ever had to learn is that, people talk about, you hear people talk about like what got you here won't get you there. And the unfortunate reality is in most cases that's people, right? And I gotta tell you, I can tell you the hardest decisions I've ever made in my life, the absolute hardest, gut-wrenching, worst, and in many cases, the ones with the absolute worst consequences or unintended consequences were when you have somebody that was a really important piece of the puzzle to get you through a certain time period or through a stage of growth or whatever, and you get to a point where there's no longer a fit for them or they're no longer the person. And you don't have, and you haven't created a world where you get to just where you have unlimited resources, right? So you don't get to be a charity in some of those cases. Those are the apps. I mean, that's the bar none hard being a business, being a team is having to navigate those conversations where you have somebody that is no longer a fit for where you're trying to go and where you're trying to head. And every part of me will delay and delay and delay and delay and delay that decision, because I just absolutely do not want to make it. I hate it. It's not who I want to be. It's not, and all of those things. And I will delay that decision to the point where it's doing damage to the rest of the team. Right? Like it's causing more pain and suffering for other people. And I ultimately have to get to that part where I recognize, oh, right, I am, we're responsible for all of these people, not just this one. And so we need to find a way to do that, right? So I'm super proud to say that we've had some amazing examples of helping those people find their next thing. Does that make sense? So we've launched a lot of people into other, other companies or their own company or some of those other things. And there's been some of those that I'm super proud of. And to this day, I have great relationships with a lot of those people.
And I
But
have to give
oh,
you a
you
I have to
can't
give you a
talk about
compliment too, because you've made me your response made me a little bit emotional, as well as did other responses, which is interesting because you haven't gotten the most emotional in your answers, and yet. So a compliment that I want to pay to you is you're introspective and aware enough to where this isn't, you say hire slow, fire fast. While that's a fantastic guiding light, it's not easy for you. And I
I
think that's what
don't.
makes it right, in my personal opinion, is the fact that it never becomes easier.
No.
It's just the fact of the matter that this position that was amazing, we've now outgrown, or we pivoted away from, or the company just evolved into different directions. So
That's
I wanted to
exactly
do
right.
that.
So
Tate,
it's hard. Yeah. Yeah, it
thank
was
you so
great.
much. Thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. This has been fantastic.
It was wonderful to spend some time with you. So hopefully, I pray that somebody out there gets some knowledge out of this, that it helps them and makes their journey easier. So that is my hope and my goal. So if anybody, if I'd love if anybody ever listens to this, and there's anything they gain from it, I'd love to know, and just to be a cheerleader and be excited about
Yeah,
their
that's
journey.
the last thing. How do we reach out to you?
Absolutely, yeah.
How do
So,
people engage?
absolutely. So, the answer is the only thing I'm really active on is LinkedIn. So
Okay.
you can find me on LinkedIn, Tate Fisher. There's not very many of us, so that makes it easier. And I'm not a long brunette female that teaches personal fitness. So, which is
Fisher.
Fisher. I
Gotcha.
like to make a joke, or freshwater fishers, no sea.
Excellent.
So
With
that's it.
Catalyst Group. Excellent.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yep. And Catalyst Group, or Catalyst dot group, and we spell Catalyst with a K. So for all of you K-staters out there, Catalyst was birthed in Manhattan, Kansas, which is where my first company headquarters was. And so, when you're starting businesses in Manhattan, they all have to start with a K. That's the law. That's the rules. So I don't make them. I just
There you go.
abide by
Okay.
them. Right?
Okay.
So,
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All
yeah,
right. All right.
100%.
All right.
Cool.
So with that, I'd say bye,
Yeah.
everybody.
See ya.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.